Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and as you've heard, Senator Rand Paul staged an old-fashioned talking filibuster on the Senate floor yesterday afternoon into early this morning, 13 hours, officially against the nomination of John Brennan as CIA director, but really against the Obama administration's suggestion that they could, in theory, under the law, attack U.S. citizens on U.S. soil with drone strikes with no due process in court if they were suspected terrorists. We'll put the drone issue in the context of military history with historian Max Boot coming up. But first, here is a two-minute montage of moments from the filibuster, which forced Senator Paul to hold it in for 13 hours.
I rise today to begin to filibuster John Brennan's nomination for the CIA.
I will speak
until I can no longer
speak. I will
speak as long as it takes. Until the alarm is sounded from coast to coast.
Our Constitution is important.
And I have no intention of killing Americans, but I might.
The point isn't that anybody in our country is Hitler.
That in a democracy, you could someday elect someone who is very evil.
I don't rise to oppose John Brennan's nomination simply for the person. I rise today for the principle.
As I mentioned, Hayek said that this is what distinguishes us.
They say Lewis Carroll is fiction. Alice never fell down a rabbit hole, and the White Queen's caustic judgments are not really a threat to your security.
For another 12 hours to try to break Strom Thurmond's record, but I've discovered that there are some limits to filibustering, and I'm going to have to go take care of one of those in a few minutes here. But I do appreciate the Senate's forbearance in this. And I hope that if there are some on the other side of the aisle who have been listening...
Rand Paul from his 13-hour filibuster, the Republican senator from Kentucky, and chip off the old block. This debate over drone strikes on suspected terrorists turns out to be just today's wrinkle in an age-old story that remains surprisingly consistent from the time of Alexander the Great to the time of Barack Obama and David Petraeus. Military historian Max Boot has written a new book called Invisible Armies, an epic history of guerrilla warfare from ancient times to the present. And it certainly is epic at over 700 pages. Max Boot is also senior fellow in national security studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks for having me on again, Brian.
And to begin on the news of the day, is the Rand Paul filibuster an example of how wars by great powers against insurgents wind up dividing the empire's population against itself?
I don't think there's actually that much division on the use of drone strikes. I mean, I know Rand Paul is opposed to them, but I think most Americans don't have a problem with sending out these drones to target terrorist leaders overseas.
I'm not sure he even had a problem with them when used in that way. He was trying to bring it all the way back to this country and the fact that the Obama administration seemed to be keeping the legal door open a crack for that.
Right. Well, it seems like a very theoretical concern. I don't really envision predators operating over our skies blasting individuals with Hellfire missiles. I think all the Obama administration was saying that they reserve the right to use military force against enemy combatants on American soil, which I think is a pretty mainstream and well-established legal position. I think Rand Paul is not in the mainstream with his viewpoint.
Well, you write in the book, time and again, guerrilla warfare seemed to be superseded by the new thing, industrial warfare in the 1910s, aerial warfare in the 1930s, nuclear warfare in the 1950s, network-centric warfare in the 1990s, and yet each time it reasserted itself with a vengeance, the insurgents or guerrillas did. So following that pattern, if drone strikes are the newest new thing, do you expect guerrilla warfare to, as you write, reassert itself with a vengeance, or is it too soon to tell?
Oh, I don't think guerrilla warfare is going anywhere. I mean, we see it today. I mean, what was the last conventional war that the world has seen, the last war pitting two uniform military forces against one another? That would have been the Russian invasion of Georgia in 2008. And yet we see every day thousands of people, unfortunately, dying in places like Afghanistan, Syria, Mali, Myanmar, Colombia, Mexico, and many other places. They are dying in irregular conflicts, not in conventional military engagements. And the point I make in my book, Invisible Armies, is there's nothing unusual about this. This has always been the dominant and most ubiquitous form of warfare ever since mankind first emerged on this earth. We need to shift our thinking because we tend to talk about irregular or unconventional conflict as if there's something wrong with it, as if this is not the way you're supposed to fight. But in fact, this is the way that people have always fought predominantly, and it's always been conventional wars that have been the exception, and much more so in recent years when they've become extremely rare. So, you know, no matter what happens in Afghanistan or some of the other conflicts that we're involved in right now, I think it's safe to predict that there will be, for better or for worse, a lot more unconventional warfare against terrorists and guerrillas in our future.
And yet the Obama administration, I think to even a larger degree the Bush administration, argued that the reason that they could do almost anything they wanted to fight insurgents under the Geneva Conventions is that they were not regular armies and regular soldiers in uniforms, but quote-unquote illegal enemy combatants. So do you think that's not a distinction that reflects the history of the world?
I think there is a distinction there, but the larger problem that we face is that we don't have a good legal framework for dealing with this kind of warfare. And we certainly try to divide unconventional from conventional conflict, and we have the laws of war, which are meant to provide protections for uniformed combatants who abide by the laws of war and display their arms openly and wear uniforms and all these other things. But then when you meet most enemies in the field, they don't meet that definition. And so we're kind of left scratching our head trying to figure out what to do about them. And right now, we're actually in a complete stalemate because we're still holding something like 120 or whatever the figure is, detainees at Guantanamo in this very indefinite long-term enemy combatant status. But yet at the same time as we're keeping Gitmo open, we're not actually, the Obama administration is not adding any new detainees at Gitmo because they don't know what legal framework they would use to add new people. And so one of the problems with these drone strikes is there is no possibility of actually capturing and interrogating these terrorist leaders because there's no legal framework for doing that. Mm-hmm. So essentially we're left with the choice of either let them go or blow them up. And that's not a good option, but that's where we are because we don't have the right legal framework for dealing with this kind of warfare.
You write in the book that guerrilla groups have been getting more successful since the end of World War II, in part because of the growth of public opinion and policymaking. How so?
Well, it's been a huge difference. I did a database as part of this book which showed that insurgents were winning about 20% of their campaigns prior to 1945, and since 1945, they've been winning about 40%. But what's changed in the last several decades? I would argue it's the growing power of the mass media and of international organizations, of public opinion. And you've seen examples of that recently, where in 2011, Muammar Gaddafi tried to put down a rebellion against his rule. And 100 years ago, he undoubtedly would have succeeded. But what happened this time around? The very fact that he was preparing to go in there and inflict punishment on Benghazi mobilized an international coalition that ultimately wound up bringing him down and led to his death. That's how public opinion has changed the calculus of this kind of warfare, and it's really provided an advantage to insurgents that they did not enjoy before in the pre-media age.
So to bring it back to Rand Paul and his filibuster, and to the extent that public opinion is divided on drones, is this kind of democratic protest for due process for suspected enemy insurgents unique to our country or to our time in history?
It's not unique. There have always been debates over the methods that are used to fight insurgents. Even during our own revolution, there was a lot of debate within British society over whether British forces were being too cruel or not to the or being too kind, in fact, to the American rebels. There were similar debates in many other conflicts. For example, the most notoriously in the Algerian War of Independence in the 1950s, when the French used torture and very heavy-handed violence and thereby caused an international public reaction against them. So it's actually pretty common in the last couple of centuries that the methods that counterinsurgents use to fight rebel and terrorist groups, those methods themselves become very controversial. And if they are sufficiently barbaric, which I don't think is the case with these drone strikes, but if with more barbaric methods, including, for example, some of the abuses that occurred at Abu Ghraib, for example, that can actually cause the entire campaign to backfire because it can mobilize international public opinion against you.
And I guess it's a question of barbaric in the eyes of whom? Because we saw your piece in the Weekly Standard from late January where you wrote that drone strikes all but eliminate risks on our side and that they're antiseptic. But at the same time, you write about in the book the so-called Hydra effect, that when you try to fight insurgent guerrillas, you sometimes, you know, by killing some of them or inadvertently killing civilians around them, you wind up with a perception problem, and that creates more terrorists.
Oh, absolutely.
And
that's
a huge issue.
Yeah.
I wonder if you think that's happening with drones more than it's worth.
It's hard to know in the case of drone strikes, and I certainly am not an apologist for the drone strikes. I have some issues with them as well. I'm not sure they're the end-all and be-all in this kind of warfare. And you certainly raise one of the issues, which is what is the impact that they have on public opinion in the targeted countries? And so far, the evidence goes both ways. There is some evidence that certainly that badly aimed drone strikes that wind up killing civilians, they can certainly radicalize people and create more enemies than you eliminate. However, John Brennan, the CIA nominee, will argue that, in fact, in a number of instances, these drone strikes have actually been welcomed by the targeted population in places like the northwest frontier of Pakistan, where the local people resent the power of local warlords who are part of these terrorist groups, and they actually welcome their removal. So I think it's hard to reach a perfect conclusion right now about what the impact on public opinion of these drone strikes has been, in part because we don't have people on the ground. I mean, these are happening in areas where it's very hard to interview people and find out what has been the impact.
Max Boot, military historian, author of Invisible Armies, An Epic History of Guerrilla Warfare from Ancient Times to the Present. Is there a difference between a guerrilla, an insurgent, and a terrorist?
Yes, but the differences are very hard to define because, as the old cliche has it, one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter. And what I basically argue in my book is that there is a gradation of warfare, with terrorists being at the very bottom, usually groups of a few dozen, maybe a few hundred individuals who are too weak to do anything except attack civilian populations and are incapable of holding territory or winning conventional military victories. Whereas guerrilla groups tend to be somewhat larger. They can be tens of thousands or even hundreds of thousands. They can actually hold territory and establish shadow governments. So that differentiates them from terrorists. And in terms of who's an insurgent and who's not, basically anybody who's trying to overthrow the established order is an insurgent. And that defines most terrorists and most guerrillas of the past couple of hundred years. But it excludes most guerrillas of the millennia before that, because most guerrillas throughout history have not been insurgents. They've been these nomadic raiders like the Huns or like our own Sioux and Apache, who don't use public opinion, who don't use the media, who aren't even literate, but who and are fighting not because, you know, they've studied Mao and read the classics of insurgent literature, but are using these raiding tactics simply because that's the way they've always fought and their forefathers before them. It's a very kind of instinctual kind of guerrilla warfare that used to be the dominant form of guerrilla warfare. But in the last couple of centuries, you've had the addition of politics and public opinion to this kind of conflict, as you've seen the rise of much more sophisticated and organized insurgencies.
And example after example in your book shows that guerrilla fighters have consistently been underestimated by their enemies. Do you still think that's a problem today, with the United States underestimating the enemy in the war on terror?
Well, I think that guerrilla fighters have actually been both underestimated and overestimated. And I think prior to the post-1945 era, there was a decided tendency to underestimate them, to say that, you know, these ragtag fighters who don't even attend a staff college, what can they possibly do? And in fact, they have often humbled superpowers in the past. But since 1945, there's been a tendency to go too far in the other direction, which is to hold up guerrillas as being these 10-foot-tall superhumans who cannot possibly be defeated by military force. And a lot of that is really based on the success of a handful of high-profile insurgents like Mao Zedong or Ho Chi Minh. But we need to keep a sense of perspective and realize that just as very few business startups ever become Apple or Microsoft, so too very few fledgling insurgencies ever become the Chinese Red Army or the Vietnamese Viet Cong. Most insurgents are still defeated, but it's even if you are able to defeat them, it's not going to be quick. It's not going to be easy. It's a very protracted, bloody, and difficult kind of warfare to wage.
So in our last minute, what's your take on David Petraeus's place in history in the context of your book? He has the reputation at the moment, I think, as the, you know, counterinsurgency or the insurgency slayer for Iraq, but with many critics saying he failed with the same strategy in Afghanistan.
Well, his reputation has certainly been tarnished by the scandal which led to his downfall. But I think that his achievement in Iraq will stand in the annals of military history because what he did there is something that very few people expected could be possible, which was to bring Iraq back from the brink of all-out civil war in 2007 and reduce violence by 90% by implementing this very comprehensive counterinsurgency strategy.
In Afghanistan?
Well, he didn't have that same kind of dramatic success in Afghanistan, in part because he was only there for a year, and it's a very protracted and drawn-out conflict. So I don't think anybody's going to look to Afghanistan and say that was this amazing achievement on Petraeus's part, but I think his achievement in Iraq will still stand and will still be studied decades from now.
Council on Foreign Relations military historian Max Boot. His new book is Invisible Armies, an epic history of guerrilla warfare from ancient times to the present. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me back.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And now a call in for anyone in any field with a simple question. When you work for free, or I should say, when do you work for free, if at all? What kinds of rules have you created about giving your work away? 212-433-WNYC. The reason we raise this today is we've been watching the massive conversation that's broken out over the last few days online in the wake of a blog post detailing a journalist's exchange with Atlantic Magazine about how much they would pay for a post on their site. Now, we don't need to relitigate that specific case. Instead, let's expand the conversation even beyond just journalism or just The Atlantic and ask for anyone in any line of work, do you ever work for free? How do you weigh the possible benefits of exposure with the fact that you need to be paid for your work? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. We've been getting lots and lots of comments already on Facebook about this since we posted it yesterday from writers, photographers, even a plumber. So whatever your line of work, tell us, do you ever work for free? And what kinds of rules have you created for yourself about when to give away your work and when to insist on getting paid? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. We'll put you on the air right after this.